Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 6th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first article, Top of the Fold, Targeted Bookings Pump Up Centers Review by Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. Total events and attendance were down at the Raleigh Convention Center in the most recent fiscal year, but due to efforts to book different types of events, total revenue increased. Over the same period, total expenses have decreased throughout the convention center as still running at an operating loss. For the fiscal year that ended June 30th, the convention center booked 265 events that attracted 350,405 attendees. It's the third consecutive year of declines in both those figures from a high of 2009 and 10 of 366 events, bringing in 443,617 people. The increase in revenue is a strategic result of convention center staff booking the type of events that centers all over the country most covet, those that make use of the facility over multiple days and employ services such as catering. An example is a three-day business conference, says Laurie Okun, the center's director of marketing. Revenue increased 3.4% to $6.2 million, while expenses decreased nearly 10% to $7.7 million. While those converging figures are obviously good for operations, it's still a loss, which has been the case every year for the convention center. There's more to grading a convention center than just revenue and expenses, however. Such facilities are built to attract people from out of town who eat at restaurants and stay in hotels. While these industries pay a special tax, part of which funds facilities like the convention center, those in the restaurant and hotel industries say they support the tax because it attracts overall business. Of course, there is also the debt service. By 2037, the convention center will have paid $128 million in interest charges, bringing the true cost of the convention center project to $371 million. Budget hawks like those at the conservative-leaning John Locke Foundation say convention centers are a drain of public money, while city leaders tout these centers as points of pride that help to grow and establish the city. This week's main article is entitled, Raleigh Rising High. As developers climb out of the recession, city's metropolitan skyline grows taller. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle and is from Raleigh. When Red Hat added its red banner to the top of its new headquarters building in downtown Raleigh earlier this year, it became an unmistakable landmark for Raleigh's somewhat sparse skyline by some city's standards. The 19-story tall building, built in 2004 for Progress Energy, had nearly become hidden behind the much taller PNC Plaza Tower when it opened in 2008 as Raleigh's new dominant architecture at 33 stories tall. It's amazing what a little color can do. But with more than $300 million in new private building projects in the works for 2014 and 2015, downtown Raleigh is about to add a lot more heft and height to its brawn. First dibs on construction cranes go to the $60 million Skyhouse apartment tower that broke ground on December 4th and will stand 23 stories tall at the corner of Martin and Blount Streets, financed by an Atlanta team. Next will be the $54 million Charter Square office building at 11 stories high on the south end of Fayetteville Street, being financed by a partnership between Dominion Realty Partners of Raleigh and the real estate arm of the Prudential Insurance Company. Also on tap is the mid-rise Edison Apartments on Davie Street and the 16-story Edison office building next to Sky House. Add another five or so mid-rise apartment and hotel projects expected to break ground in the next 2 years. The Lincoln, the L Building, the Elan at Blount Street Commons, a Hilton Garden Inn, and the 11-story Residence Inn by Marriott Hotel, and Raleigh's got a mini renaissance. Almost all of these taller, more expensive building projects were originally envisioned as much taller and much more expensive when first proposed more than 6 years ago. But national economic collapse has a way of humbling real estate developers and the groups that finance them. Greg Sandrouter, managing partner for Beacon Partners Raleigh office and a development partner in the Sky House and Edison building plans, purchased the 4 acres of land for all three building projects from Progress Energy in October 2008, knowing it might take a few years to get them built. "It would be tough to assemble a piece of land like that now," says Sandrouter. "Even though our plan has changed from the original concept, what we have in place is still exciting." What has been happening in downtown Raleigh is a reflection of what has been happening in many cities across the nation. A shift back to the urban core, particularly among the millennial generation. Mitchell Silver, Raleigh's chief planning and development officer and past president of American Planning Association, notes that while cities like Atlanta and Cleveland that have been losing population are seeing a resurgence, mid-sized cities like Raleigh and Charlotte are becoming more popular because they are more affordable. "Mid-sized cities are being seen as more accessible to making your career happen," Silver says. "It's easier to build your social network. It's easier to get around. More people are looking at city living as a viable option. Most people seek to live downtown are also more transient and would prefer to rent rather than buy real estate. Since 2009, all of the new multifamily building projects that have been planned or opened in downtown have targeted renters rather than buyers. Downtown Raleigh took a hit in 2008, and in 2009, when a glut of more than 600 condominium units at 5 properties opened around the same time that the financial markets collapsed. All of those units have since sold, but it was an expensive lesson for a number of downtown investors. Raleigh business consultant Evelyn Contre says that when she and her husband sold their house a couple of years ago, they had the option to move wherever they wanted in the Triangle. "We chose downtown Raleigh because we like the energy and excitement of the revitalization of downtown. Initially, we were hyper-aware of everything going on around us. It was so different than living in any of the suburban areas around Raleigh. Over time, we've become more comfortable with our surroundings and feel very safe." Contreras says, "The only downside to living downtown is not even a fault of downtown. I would consider giving up a car if we could have reliable transportation to Durham and Chapel Hill that also ran at night," she says. "Improving transportation options through downtown Raleigh will be a key issue in a new downtown plan that city leaders will start developing in early 2014, Silver says. "It's been 10 years since the city adopted the Livable Streets Plan that led to the opening of Fayetteville Street Mall to auto traffic and other initiatives that downtown boosters credited with help generating $2.3 billion in completed or planned public and private development projects. Since then, about 60 major public and private development projects have been completed in the Central Business District, according to data tracked by Downtown Raleigh Alliance. The DRA estimates that a 6-story mixed-use building in downtown generates $110,461 in municipal tax dollars per acre. By comparison, a single-family home outside of the Central Business District would yield $2,837 in taxes per acre. This new plan, Silver says, will examine opportunities in the whole downtown district, including around McDowell and Dawson Streets, Moore Square, and other neighborhoods. Silver says he also wants to explore demolishing the Loop Road overpass at Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and McDowell Street, which could open up 12 city blocks on the south side of downtown. "When I came here 8 years ago, we were behaving like a very large town," Silver says. "I think we are now acting like a mid-sized city." While many of the new downtown projects are driven by apartment demand, office owners say they are seeing an uptick in requests for office space as well. Downtown Raleigh has about 2.8 million square feet of Class A office space with only 6.6% unoccupied. The downtown Raleigh submarket and the central Durham submarket have the lowest Class A office vacancy rates in all of the Triangle region. Dana Hugens, for example, has been leasing space for her PR and communications company in downtown Raleigh since early 2010 and decided earlier this year to buy her own office building near downtown's Oakwood neighborhood. Hugens says her decision was a deliberate statement of our commitment to downtown Raleigh. With all the accolades that Raleigh has been receiving as a vibrant business community and creative workplace, it seemed to instantly increase our profile and our credibility by having permanent space downtown, she says. That influx of new businesses, restaurants, and retailers is part of what attracted Jim Borders, president of Atlanta-based Novari Group and developer of the Sky House Tower. We are in many of the urban areas around the southeast, and downtown Raleigh at night has become the kind of restaurants and other activity that normally follows instead of leads, significant residential development, Border says. But most of downtown Raleigh building requests are not in the high-rise category, says Neil Gray, founding principal with J. Davis Architects in Raleigh, who has worked on both the Charter Square and Edison projects. Under current city guidelines, downtown building heights are capped at 40 stories. Charlotte's tallest building is 60 stories high. I'd be surprised if we ever saw anything taller than PNC Plaza at 33 stories tall, Gray says. In downtown Raleigh, there are very few sites available that can accommodate buildings like that. Plus, there's extra scrutiny when a building can be seen from miles around. You can talk about up high all you want, but what really matters is how do you feel when you walk next to it, and how do you feel getting coffee there? That's what placemaking is all about, he says. What follows is a list of the tallest buildings in downtown Raleigh. PNC Plaza, with a height of 538 feet. It has 33 floors and was built in 2008. BB&T 2 Hanover Square, 431 feet tall, 29 floors, and was built in 1991. Wells Fargo Capital Center, 400 feet, 30 floors, built in 1991. One Progress Plaza, 277 feet, 21 floors, and built in 1978. Red Hat Tower, 251 feet, 19 floors, and built in 2004. Next, coming soon to downtown Raleigh. Sky House, Raleigh. It will have a height of 264 feet and is expected to have 23 floors. It is slated to open in the fourth quarter of 2014. Charter Square is expected to have a height of 212 feet. With an expected 11 floors. It is slated to open in late 2014. The Edison office, with an expected height of 225 feet, 16 floors, and there is no projected start date for construction. And the Edison apartments, with a height of 85 feet and 7 floors, is expected to open in 2015. Next up, a small university, a big idea, and two former execs. By Jason DeBrun. Some might say Frank Sorgi was in the right place at the right time. A graduate of Duquesne University, Sorgi worked as an executive in Big Pharma for years before landing at Pantheon Pharmaceuticals, headquartered in Durham. While there, he met Greg Davis, who had more than 20 years of experience doing pharmaceutical licensing deals, with a good part of his career at GlaxoSmithKline and its predecessors. As one of the more successful graduates of the Duquesne Pharmacy Program, Sorgi also sat on the board of advisors to the dean, and at the February 2012 meeting, the school came to him with a request. Dr. Aleem Ganji, a Duquesne professor, had developed two promising new compounds to treat cancer, but the dean of the small university didn't know the best way to do a licensing deal. Major research institutions like those in the Triangle, entire offices help scientists spin out research into a commercial setting. But it was all new to Duquesne. Sorge agreed to take on the project on the side at first, but after looking at Ganji's research, he became more intrigued. He showed the research to Davis, who also saw something promising. Evaluating new pharmaceutical research for potential commercial license is something these two had done for nearly a half a century between them, but they both say they have rarely seen anything as promising as this research that was quietly underway in a small lab in Pittsburgh. Instead of finding a company like GSK to license the project, Sorge and Davis decided to form their own company, Flag Therapeutics, and take in the rights themselves. "We decide we were going to go with it," says Sorge, who owns most of the company. Around the same time, Pantheon was going through a transition. Both Sorge and Davis took severance packages and left. After working on a deal for 18 months and passing on various job offers, Sorge signed a deal with Ganji and Duquesne. Financial specifics were not released, but the deal covers two classes of small molecule water-soluble drugs designed to target and destroy cancer cells. It's the largest licensing deal ever signed by Duquesne and covers the career portfolio of Ganji, including a vast library of compounds and intellectual property portfolio protected by more than 50 U.S. and international patents or pending patents. Ironically, had this research happened at a larger university, there would have been a wider awareness of the compounds, and Duquesne would have been potentially seen more interested parties. Because of Sorge's connection to Duquesne, however, the university entrusted him with the assets, allowing him to make an offer. Of course, the compounds still have a long and expensive road to travel before they make any money. During drug development, scientists work with chemical compounds to target various diseases, cancer in this case. They test those compounds on animals first and in humans only after providing the U.S. Food and Drug Administration with enough evidence that the compounds are reasonably safe for humans and have potential benefits that outweigh the risks. At this point, the drugs have not been tested in humans, and it could cost up to $10 million to bring the lead compound from each class to their first human trials. Sorge and Davis are looking for possible investors through angel rounds, venture capital, or corporate partners. Interestingly, Davis spent much of his career on the other side of the table from where he sits now, an irony he says is not lost on him. What interested Sorge and Davis so much was how the chemical compound works. Many cancer therapies use two compounds, one to stop the growth of blood vessels to the tumor, and one to kill the cancer cells. But those are always administered separately, with the hope they arrive at the cancer cell at the same time. Sorge says this combination therapy approach is like agreeing to meet a friend at a hot dog stand at an NFL stadium without first deciding what time or which hot dog stand. By contrast, the compounds designed by Ganji incorporate the activities of both drugs typically used in combination therapy, but in a single compound, so they are guaranteed to act at the same place at the same time, as though they entered the hypothetical football stadium handcuffed together. Continuing on in Jason DeBruin's column, which covers healthcare, higher education, and nonprofits, restructuring breathes life into Oxygen Bio. It's been a busy month for Oxygen Biotherapeutics, a struggling drug development company in Morrisville. In the summer, Oxygen faced warnings that it would be delisted from NASDAQ trading. The company received a breath of new life, however, after it completed a deal that has characteristics of a reverse merger. As part of the deal, the company now has a new CEO and new members of its executive team, who all have significant ownership in the company. Oxygen also acquired a new licensing agreement and saw its stock price jump from just above $1 in September and October to more than $8 in mid-November, though it has since settled back to $6 in recent weeks. At the center is a deal with Fixus Pharma Incorporated, a drug company headquartered in New Jersey. Oxygen acquired rights to pharmaceutical products containing levosimendan, used in therapies to treat congestive heart failure. Fixus, a private company which had a deal with Orion Corporation, a Finnish company, for exclusive rights to commercialize levosimendan in the United States. That licensing agreement transferred to Oxygen. Fixus executives coming on board include John Kelly, now CEO of Oxygen, and Doug Gramble and Douglas Hayes as vice president. These executives also receive shares or warrants for shares worth up to about one quarter of Oxygen. This is why the deal has the aspects of a reverse merger in which a private company essentially folds into a shell public company and does not go through an initial public offering process, but not exactly like a reverse merger because they do not own the majority of Oxygen, and Oxygen still has another drug it's developing. Michael Jepson, who has been filling in as interim CEO of Oxygen, stays on as CFO. Oxygen also raised $6 million through 2.3 million warrant exercises in early November. In this column by the numbers, 50,000. The Obama administration says that after the Affordable Care Act website healthcare.gov went through an overhaul, it can now handle 50,000 simultaneous users, or 800,000 in one day. And 24 million. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 24 million people will buy insurance via the online insurance exchanges by 2023. Jason DeBrun's deal of the week is Durham's Adherex Technologies Incorporated. They raised $1.6 million to continue development on a cancer-fighting drug. The company is working on a cancer drug originally developed by GlaxoSmithKline, which took the drug through phase 3 clinical trials but did not see favorable results and terminated development. Adherex believes the drug can be administered orally and reduce the side effect known as hand-foot syndrome. Moving on to Lauren K. Onisoge's column, which covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. She has an article here entitled, Durham's Bike Car Opens a New Location in Portland. Rob Carter, the man behind the Elf, a bike car hybrid manufactured by Durham-based Organic Transit, confirms that another West Coast manufacturing facility is imminent. His startup, Organic Transit, which opened a San Jose manufacturing operation earlier this year, is choosing Portland as its third location. Portland is for bicycles, and green business is what Detroit is for the auto industry, Cotter says. We know we need to be there and have gotten a huge amount of interest from the state and local government, potential business partners, and customers. What he doesn't offer specifics about is the timing. He says the Portland expansion is definitely happening with an opening date that is to be announced. The wait for an Elf is about 12 weeks and growing. The bike car hybrid will be the star of an upcoming episode of A&E's Shipping Wars on December 17th at 10 p.m. The company, which counts comedian Jerry Seinfeld as a fan, recently moved to 311 West Corporation Street in Durham. And RTP in St. Louis face off to feed the world. Research Triangle Park has competition and quiet battle to dominate plant science in the United States, St. Louis. While RTP has its share of mammoths, Monsanto, Syngenta, Bayer Crop Science, and BASF, St. Louis has its own foothold with Monsanto and the Danforth Plant Science Center. While RTP has plant science resources at nearby UNC Chapel Hill, St. Louis has Washington University. While RTP has, well, RTP, St. Louis has the BRDG Park. The good news for both RTP and St. Louis is that both of us have put a stake in the ground, says Sam Fiorello, COO of Danforth. Agriculture, innovation, and the agriculture industry is really important, and we focus on it. Both places, he says, are poised for the future. But there's one thing St. Louis has that RTP doesn't. The centralized focus. Agribioscience is front and center here, Fiorello says. In RTP, it shares the spotlight with pharma and tech giants, highlighted by giants such as GlaxoSmithKline and IBM. We're not trying to out-RTP RTP, Fiorello says. In our case, it's new. It's more intimate. We have the luxury of being focused here because we don't have that diversity of thousands of jobs and vast players. It's different, not better or worse. But players here, such as BASF, are getting louder. Nigel Arms, Director of Research and Development Operations and Site Services at BASF and RTP, points out that the global biotech, which also has a footprint in St. Louis, chose RTP to relocate its global biotechnology division. His competitors, Bayer Crop Science and Syngenta, have both announced that and embarked on extensive expansions in RTP. RTP is a stronghold, Arms says. Jim Carrington, director of Danforth, shies away from comparison with RTP. He prefers to look at both St. Louis and RTP as winning underdogs in the nation, where, traditionally, investment has focused around two states, California and Boston. St. Louis, he's quick to point out, is still developing. Danforth, along with Monsanto's research operations, are expanding quickly. There is a very fast-growing innovation community and a fast-growing innovation culture here, Carrington says. There's a lot of room for a lot of leaders in the space because agriculture industry is so broad. There are going to be a lot of success stories. On another note, startup Flying South. A Raleigh startup is flying south this winter. I spoke to Ben Thuss, co-founder of TripTap, a tenant of HQ Raleigh, who tells me that his startup is moving to Atlanta. Thuss, who had planned on participating in Raleigh's new Living Learning Entrepreneurial Community, ThinkHouse, leaves this week. It was really a hard process for us, he says. We have really enjoyed living in Raleigh, and we built up a lot of friends and connections around HQ and the ThinkHouse, so it's definitely not something we took lightly. But my business partner and I are 100% committed to this business, so this seemed like the best move for us to make. Good luck, fellas. Next up, startup connects donors with needy families. Think Imagine Angel Tree meets Amazon Wishlist, and you'll get the gist of what a team of entrepreneurs at UNC is trying to create with their for-profit social venture. Called Communigift, the super early startup based at 1789 Venture Lab in Chapel Hill bills itself as a one-stop shop for giving and gifting online. Users can sponsor disadvantaged families directly through the platform. Additionally, they can request, organize, and purchase gifts for families and friends, and that's where the for-profit side comes in. Co-founder Thomas Dochen says the idea came to him last Christmas. I'd given my parents a wish list of 20 items, and they got 6 items for me. Everything was a surprise, he says. But he started thinking about people whose holiday wish list would go unanswered. People, he says, want to give. They just need the convenience factor provided by his service. They don't have time to go out and research a nonprofit, to go to Target and get a gift, he says. His service allows people to find vetted families and to get to know them through a description before giving, and while they are there, they can fill out their own wish lists. His platform allows a family to see what everyone is asking for so that your grandma and your aunt don't buy you the same video game. You can do this with your friend group as well, he says. And an Amazon partnership means up to 15% of the purchases made through the site go back to the business. Some of that will also go toward helping needy families, but the amount has not yet been determined. The team has raised $10,000 to pay for legal fees via a sole angel investor and plans to raise between $100,000 and $200,000 in the early part of 2014 to flesh out the concept. We have a lot of ideas we want to build on, he says. Entrepreneurs behind the effort include Dochen, Taylor Sharp, and Jake Bernstein, all sophomores at UNC. Aaron Scarborough, founder of 1789, calls the trio a feel-good story in time for the holidays. 1789 Venture Lab is a Franklin Street-based entrepreneurial co-working space in Chapel Hill that focuses on recent and current students at UNC. The space opened in May and intends to work with earlier phase startups than their Chapel Hill counterpart, Launch Chapel Hill. This week's column under Lauren K. Onisorge, by the numbers, is as follows. 19%. On Black Friday, sales increased 19% over 2012. The average order value for Black Friday was up more than 2% compared to last year at $135.27. 39.7%. An IBM report shows mobile traffic grew to 39.7% of all online traffic, an increase of 34% over last year. 24.9%. the percentage of sales through smartphones, and as it turns out, iOS users are less thrifty than their Android counterparts. Apple's iOS users spent an average of $127 per 92 cents per order, compared to $105.20 by Android users. And finally, 18.7%. IBM's research for Cyber Monday shows that online sales are up 18.7% as of December 2nd at 3 p.m. Also, Triangle CEOs you should be following on Twitter. Which Triangle CEO should you follow on Twitter? To answer that question, the Triangle Business Journal referenced the annual book of lists and scoured names for the top executives at companies that are headquartered in the Triangle. The TBJ then embarked on a quest to round up as many local CEO Twitter handles as they could find. What's interesting, more so than CEOs was found tweeting, are the CEOs not tweeting. The latter group includes Highwoods Property CEO Ed Fritsch and billionaire SaaS CEO Jim Goodnight. Of the CEOs who are on Twitter, few have followings that befit their stations. In first place is Ping Fu. She has 1,011 tweets, 589 following, and 2,028 followers. Joe Colopi, the CEO of Bronto Software, has about 1,388 tweets, 150 following, and 936 following. Number three is Scott Wingo, CEO and founder of Channel Advisor, has recently 1,925 tweets, 1,240 followers, and 5,084 following. Jim Whitehurst of Red Hat, 131 tweets, 28 followers, and 5,004 following. Judd Bowman, CEO of Aquas, has 56 tweets, 77 followers, and 646 following. And number six is Stephen Wehe. He has 22 tweets, 297 followers, and 97 following. Next up, Amanda Hoyle. Amanda covers commercial and residential real estate. And this week's article from Amanda states that NC Buildings take home hardware. Several North Carolina architects, engineers, and builders racked up awards this year at the ENC Southeast Best Projects Competition Showcase. The Best Higher Education Research Project at the library at NCSU by the name of James B. Hunt. It combines digital technology and contemporary structure to fulfill the university's need for more library research and study group facilities for students and faculty. The Skanska USA Building Incorporated team from Durham was the general contractor for the building. Designer of the project was a collaboration between Sonetta and the Raleigh office of Clark Nexen. Structural engineer was Stewart Engineering of Raleigh, civil engineering from the Charlotte office of Cole Genest and Stone, and mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineering by Chapel Hill office of Affiliated Engineers Incorporated. The best K-12 school, the winner was Sandy Grove Middle School in Lumberton. The school was built by a public-private partnership between project developer First Floor, K-12 Systems, LLC of Raleigh, and Hope County School Systems. The campus had about 2,300 solar panels generating about 589.9 kilowatts annually, achieving the rare status of being a net positive building. The Metcon Incorporated team in Pembroke was a general contractor. The Raleigh office of SFL&A Architects served as a designer. Crawford Design of Fayetteville was a civil engineer, and LHC Structural Engineers of Raleigh was the structural engineer. Optima of Charlotte was a mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineering firm. And the best green building project, the winner was the Facebook Data Center in Forest City. The Facebook Data Center project in Forest City was designed to meet LEED gold standards. The DPR construction team in Morrisville was the general contractor for the building. Sheehan Partners of Chicago was the architect. Alpha Tech of San Jose, California was the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineer. And McGill Associates of Hickory was the civil engineer. This week's By the Numbers for Amanda Hoyle's column is as follows. 17%. New housing construction in the Triangle is outpacing the national average, with reports showing that the two largest counties in the Triangle region are growing. The percent increase in Wake and Durham counties in new residential building permits in October was 17%. 13.9% is the amount nationally that building permits for new housing units went up in October, according to a joint report from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development at the U.S. Census Bureau. And 483 is the number of new residential building permits that were approved in October by the Wake County Revenue Department, up 19% from the year prior. This week's column for Dawn Curry, Dawn covers money and small business, leads an article with an article called Carolina Theater is Back in the Black. The Carolina Theater of Durham reported a profit of $69,000 in its 2012-13 fiscal year, the first year in the black since 2008 and the second highest profitable year since 2002. According to the 2012-13 fiscal year financial statements, the surplus marks a $266,000 improvement in annual performance from the prior year. The theater still has a deficit of $266,000, which was reduced from last year's $334,000 deficit. The nonprofit CEO, Bob Nosek, says investing in the theater and not being afraid to hire new staff has allowed the theater's annual revenue to grow by 41% over the last 2 years. We are going to continue to operate conservatively, he says. We've eliminated losses. It's been a difficult few years, but we've created a national destination. The theater currently has 18 full-time employees with several part-time employees. The theater has made several upgrades to the facilities following the renovation in 2011, which closed the theater for 4 months and caused a loss of $188,072 during that time. Nosek says the theater has since replaced an outdated phone system, installed a new ticket point of sale, and upgraded the sound systems in the cinemas. In November, the theater implemented a full digital conversion in order to show movies on hard drives, a $110,000 upgrade aimed at helping the theater compete with regular cinemas. In 2014, our biggest plans are looking to replace the seats in the cinemas, which were installed in 1994. They're not comfortable. Nosek adds that he hopes to be able to renovate the star dressing rooms, which haven't been changed since the early 90s, and install monitors around the theater to display showtimes. Dawn Curry also reports that a shorter holiday season is for small businesses. With five fewer holiday shopping days this year between Thanksgiving and Christmas, local retailers and small shops will need to bob and weave to help consumers, says Andy Allen, president of the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association. Retailers have got to be nimble and manage inventory because the shopping time is shorter, he says. Despite the crunch time hustle and bustle, Allen said shoppers are more optimistic this holiday season compared to the past few. With another decline in the state unemployment rate just announced, people are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, he said. Compared to previous holiday shopping seasons, Ellen said small retailers are mimicking large retailers in their outreach strategy, such as directly emailing customers and taking advantage of social media outlets. Retailers are making special efforts this holiday season to stand out, like banding together with other small businesses to offer events like wine tastings or charity events. Dawn Curry's side column is For the Dogs. The top five pet groomers in the Triangle are, if you haven't scheduled to have Fido or Fifi boarded or cleaned up for the holidays, here are the top-rated groomers according to customer reviews on Yelp.com. Dogtopia in Cary. Owned by Diane Heath, Dogtopia restricts grooming to pets being boarded and features an open daycare and live webcams. Dogtopia is located at 507 James Jackson Avenue in Cary. Number two on the list is Pups Day Out in Raleigh. Pups Day Out calls itself a play care and offers boarding, grooming, and playtime. Pups Day Out is located at 2412 Atlantic Avenue in Raleigh. Number three on the list is All About Pets Grooming, Raleigh. All About Pets Grooming is busy around the holidays, says owner and groomer Jenny Fierst. She might groom between 30 and 50 dogs in a single day. All About Pets is located at 240 Newton Road in Raleigh. Pupsy in Cary. Pupsy offers dog training along with boarding and grooming with 5,000 square feet and indoor and outdoor play areas. Pupsy is located at 8260 Chapel Hill Road in Cary. And number five on the top five pet groomers in the Triangle is Care First Animal Hospital in Morrisville. Care First offers veterinarians pet sitting and grooming 5 days a week. Reviewers rated the business highly for the attentive care of the staff. Care First is located at 11010 Lake Grove Boulevard in Morrisville. This week's column on the Washington Watch is by Mr. Kent Hoover. Mr. Hoover is the chief of Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. His column starts off with an article entitled, Small Businesses Can't Enroll Online for Obamacare Until Next November. The Obama administration announced a one-year delay in small businesses' ability to enroll for health insurance through healthcare.gov, the federal government's troubled online exchange. This marks the third and most significant delay for the Small Business Health Options program, the part of healthcare.gov that was supposed to provide small businesses with better deals for health insurance by pooling their purchasing power and increasing competition among insurers. Online enrollment originally was scheduled to begin October 1 when healthcare.gov launched for individuals but was pushed back a month. Then Marilyn Tavner, administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, told Congress that online enrollment for the SHOP exchange wouldn't be ready until the end of November. Now, that date has been pushed back until November 2014. On that date, small businesses will also be able to let their employees pick up their own plans from the exchange. Until then, small businesses can only pick one plan to cover all their workers. The one-year delay applies to only online enrollment in the federal exchange, which covers residents in 36 states that opted not to create their own exchanges for individuals and small businesses. Kevin Coleman, manager of legislative affairs for the National Federation of Independent Business, says the delay shows that small businesses continue to be low on the priority list during the Obamacare implementation business. It probably matters little to people in Washington that the failure to get the small business exchanges online adds yet another onerous paperwork requirement for job creators. Also, court gives business win over National Labor Relations Board in fight over arbitration agreements. Companies can force employees to sign arbitration agreements that prohibit class action lawsuits, a federal appeals court has ruled. The Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals overturned the National Labor Relations Board, which ruled that home builder D.R. Horton Incorporated violated workers' rights by forcing them to agree to resolve all employment-related disputes individually through arbitration. The arbitration agreement prohibited workers from making class action claims against the Texas company. The NLRB held the company's mandatory arbitration agreement violated the National Labor Relations Act because it required employees to waive their rights to join together to challenge company decisions. The board also ruled that the agreement would lead employees to believe they couldn't file unfair labor charges with the NLRB. The appeals court, however, overturned the NLRB's decision, including the agency failed to give proper weight to the Federal Arbitration Act, which requires that arbitration agreements be enforced according to their terms, unless Congress has specified otherwise. But the court agreed with the NLRB that D.R. Horton must clarify that the arbitration agreement does not preclude employees from pursuing claims of unfair labor practices with the NLRB. The court's decision to allow D.R. Horton to include a ban on class actions in its arbitration agreement is significant because many employers have taken this step in response to a boom in employment-related class action lawsuits. This week's column, Legal Focus by Jim Verdonik, is entitled, Will There Be a Hybrid Under Your Christmas Tree? He writes, Every year I write an article about what to get entrepreneurs for Christmas, a notoriously difficult group to buy for. Stressed out gift shoppers should be pleased to know they are off the hook. All entrepreneurs will be getting a hybrid. Not a hybrid car, a hybrid way to raise capital that is cheap and efficient. That's what entrepreneurs have been writing letters to Santa for every year since the 2001 internet bubble crash started the venture capital industry into a death spiral. Santa may have disappointed entrepreneurs for a dozen years, but entrepreneurs have kept writing their letters, and Santa has finally delivered joy to the world. Most people have heard about the crowdfunding rules the SEC recently proposed that will likely become effective in 2014. I doubt these new rules will benefit many entrepreneurs. Financial statement audits and review requirements and post-closing annual reports with the SEC in perpetuity will make crowdfunding too expensive for most businesses, especially because you can only raise $1 million per year. Requirements that you use only one crowdfunding platform and limits on your off-platform social media and other advertising to boring tombstone notices will restrict your ability to market your deal outside of one platform. But these limits only relate to pure crowdfunding deals. Hybrid crowdfunding deals will put the capital-raising spark into most entrepreneurs this Christmas. Hybrid deals use crowdfunding platforms to conduct Rule 506C offerings. Hybrids give you 1. Unlimited social media and solicitations as long as you don't commit fraud. 2. Maximum flexibility about what you disclose to investors and how you disclose it with no requirements for expensive audit or reviewed financial statements. 3. Exemption from state rules that require pre-sale filings and reviews by state security administrators, which can cause delays and extra offering expenses. 4. No limits on capital you can raise. 5. No post-sale filing requirements except Form D with the SEC in some states. The downside to Ruling 506C offerings is that you must sell only to accredited investors and take reasonable steps to verify that all investors are accredited. Crowdfunding platforms that specialize by industry will attract investors that are interested in that particular industry. They will be like cable TV channels, you know, which channels specialize in news, sports, movies, etc. Investors seeking certain types of deals will gravitate to crowdfunding platforms that specialize in their type of deal. That's a valuable service. If you comply with Rule 506C's accredited investor verification rules, you will be able to do Rule 506C offerings through crowdfunding platforms. Indeed, until the SEC's proposed crowdfunding rules become effective, these hybrid offerings will be the only deals you can do through crowdfunding platforms. Crowdfunding platforms will be one of the many types of technology and marketing services people operate to facilitate 506C offerings. This will offer and allow businesses raising capital to use social media in creative ways to drive people to their crowdfunding platform offering instead of being limited to ineffective tombstone advertisements. This crowdfunding hybrid Christmas present will allow you to have your cake and eat it too. Doesn't that sound like Christmas? Happy holidays, everyone. This week's Triangle Business Journal op-ed column is by the Photographer's Notebook. John West joined the Triangle Business Journal as a staff photographer in October. And his column is entitled, Community Stories Often Told in Photos. Ansel Adams said, There are always two people in every picture, the photographer and the viewer. In my opinion, nothing could be further from the truth. I've never thought of photography as a solitary endeavor, but a journey of chance encounters, serendipitous moments, and interactions with people. To me, photography starts with community. My photographic niche, documentary photojournalism, offers me these experiences daily. While exploring my community through my lens and my work, I share these experiences with you, the viewer. A bit of a background. I received my Bachelor's of Arts in Photojournalism from Point Park University in Pittsburgh. I worked for several publications within that city and surrounding communities, eventually making the move back to Raleigh. Yes, I said back. Although I've been away for some time, North Carolina is my home state. The move here was a blessing in disguise because it gave me the chance to focus more on my own company, producing multimedia documentaries for corporate clients. The move also provided me with the ability and time to raise, fund, and produce my own personal documentaries, something I never had time for. I have produced documentaries and photo essays in Ireland, Panama, Cuba, Argentina, Mexico, and I have had the fortunate opportunity to travel the United States several times working on in-depth projects and assignments. In 2011, I returned to Elon University to obtain a master's degree in interactive media. I wanted to expand my knowledge about the functionality of the web and how documentaries could generate interactivity and audience engagement. In 2012, I received a master's in arts degree in interactive media and added more tools to my now expanded toolbox. My wife tells me that chances and opportunities are established by the choices you make, and the people you choose to surround yourself with define you. She's right, isn't she? Today, the choices I've made have led to this opportunity to establish a career at the Triangle Business Journal and be part of a strong, purposeful, outstanding family of journalists and professionals. I wanted to return to a sense of community, and my new position provides me with a canvas to paint my masterpiece, and I look forward to sharing my palette with you. This week's guest opinion is from Mr. Neil Westergaard. Mr. Westergaard is the editor of the Denver Business Journal. Say glitch to lay blame elsewhere. We're hearing the word glitch a lot these days. Everything, it seems, is suffering from glitches. Computer glitches, ordering glitches, credit card glitches. It's the word we use when we don't have enough information to call out the person who made a mistake. My bank called me the other day and told me it had a glitch with its security. The bank had received a security notice that some unknown schmuck hacked into the files at a retailer I must have bought something from online with my debit card. My personal information had been compromised. What retailer? They didn't know. Only that my debit card was being canceled, so the glitch didn't cause money to be drained from my account without my knowledge, as opposed to how it's usually drained with my full and complete knowledge. I'd have a new card in no time, 7 to 10 business days. How thoughtful of them. I'd need that time to notify all the places where I'd set up automatic pay plans on the glitch card for recurring billing. The new federal health law has been in the news lately for widespread glitches on the National Health Insurance Exchange website. And anyone who watches Fox News knows the person responsible for long wait times and long account signups. It's the president himself. That's who. He's the glitch in chief. He even admitted it. He held a news conference and said the glitches were unacceptable and made it sound like he was going to roll up his sleeves and get right on over to Health and Human Services and start rewriting code. I wonder if he knows Ruby on Rails. That's a web application that runs the Ruby programming language for you non-techies. Before glitches, we attributed problems like those Uncle Sam is having to gremlins. Some people liked that a lot better than glitch. You can picture in your mind what a gremlin looks like, thanks to Hollywood. Not so with a glitch. Glitch is thought to come from the Yiddish word glitzen, which means to slide or glide, or more appropriately, a slippery place, a place that I'm sure now resonates with President Obama. Its first known use, according to the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary, was in 1962, but it doesn't say in what context it was used. Popular Dancing with the Stars program on ABC revealed its own glitch. The popular Dancing with the Stars program on ABC revealed its own glitch recently by making viewers endure 2 hours of writhing, scantily clad women and shirtless men before revealing that no couple would be eliminated in last week's episode because on-screen television call-in numbers were wrong. So viewers were deprived of watching the pathetic losers be told they were leaving right now and wouldn't be able to go to the dance studio anymore to do the Paso Doble or the Viennese Waltz with obscenely fit and nimble professional dance partners. Of course, these glitches paled in terms of impact compared to a recent Facebook glitch that prevented people from posting for a period of time, depriving all the Facebook friends' communities from learning about what people had for breakfast or how they slept the night before. As one WAG observed, office productivity took a huge leap forward. Denver has its share of glitches. Remember when the city received national and international scorn for its dysfunctional baggage handling system at the newly built Denver International Airport? It was state-of-the-art, but suitcases routinely got hurled or lost off the conveyor belt system, breaking apart and spreading everybody's underwear all over the place. We were the brunt of late-night talk show jokes for years, even after the system was mothballed. I still get people asking me on airline flights about the balky baggage system. They're worried their bags will be lost when they change planes in Denver. I tell them not to worry, unless there's a glitch. Home isn't the only place Triangle employees turned to for turkey last week. Just ask Joe Calopi, CEO of Bronto Software, who is in the belief that a working Thanksgiving is worth the time and expense. We want to acknowledge and be thankful for the little and big things that we do for each other every day, he says, adding that it's not just about saying thanks. We put a high value on culture at Bronto. Beyond being another excuse to socialize, these events help make unexpected connections between Brontos that lead to interesting innovations down the road. His specialty this year? Puerto Rican Chocolate Delights, a family recipe passed down from my grandmother to my mother to me. Others claim that it was really German chocolate brownies purchased from Whole Foods, cut up and put in a different pan. But I consider it all a gray area. For Red Hat CTO Brian Stevens, an office in Raleigh's Red Hat Tower wasn't in the plan. Stevens told his high school guidance counselor he wanted to be a carpenter. That was it, he tells Dice.com. Zero interest elsewhere. But his guidance counselor disagreed with his life choice. He said, "You're going to have a regular job and carpentry is going to be your hobby," Stevens says, adding that his counselor thought computers and engineering would be in his future. His career advice? Too often, folks get too focused on what they're going to do, he says, what they're going to build, what tools they're going to use. Get connected with the marketplace, with what the marketplace needs, then fill in that with the skills and deliver on that. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next week at the same time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.